The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So last night I began talking about point three in the Lojong teachings, the 7 points and 59 slogans for generating compassion and resilience. And point three is about using the previous teachings to live our lives in a way that does the least harm and that recognizes that everything is the awakened nature. So I'll just read them and then comment on at least one of them and maybe two. So point three is transform bad circumstances into the path. And this is Norman Fisher's translation. Turn all mishaps into the path. Drive all blames into one. Be grateful to everyone. See confusion as Buddha and practice emptiness. Do good, avoid evil. Appreciate your lunacy. Pray for help. Whatever you meet is the path. So these six slogans are all revolving around a similar teaching that whatever we meet is the path. Whatever we meet, good or bad, liking it or not liking it, it transforms when we allow the energy of bodhi, of awakening, to affect our own sense perceptions of whatever is happening. So instead of immediately going to right and wrong, we go to a kind of curiosity. What is this? What is this thing that we're meeting right now? And could it, even though it seems like the worst thing ever, be the path of awakening? Be the great way, the great Tao manifesting itself. Could this be possible? So last night I talked quite a bit about turning all mishaps into the path. Today I want to talk about see confusion as Buddha and practice emptiness. And depending on what happens, maybe going to the next one, do good, avoid evil. Appreciate your lunacy and pray for help. So this seeing confusion as the Buddha and practicing emptiness, this is Norman Fisher's translation. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and his student Pema Chodron say it a little bit differently. Seeing confusion as the four kayas is unsurpassable shunyata protection. You can see why Norman Fisher translated it into ordinary English for us. And the meaning is pretty much the same, but understanding what the four kayas are and what unsurpassable shunyata protection is very much related to the next point, which ends with pray for help. So there is a sense that the world is made of the Dharma. Dharma is a word that means the things of the world. It also means the teachings. And I love the fact that the word means the same thing. It means many other things as well. But just turning on those two meanings, the things of the world and the teachings. So everything that arises for us is a teaching. And not in the sense of maybe a Judeo-Christian theistic, I should say maybe also Islamist teaching that there is a person who is in charge of showing us particular lessons and that everything that happens to us is somebody saying, I think this would be good if you had this thing happen to you and then you would learn this lesson. That could be true. I won't deny it, but in Buddhism, we talk about this a little differently, that things just arise. And it's our job as people of the way to pull teachings from what is arising, to use our upright sitting posture and our presence and our meeting everything as a way to understand how the world actually works. And I've got to say, from my own point of view, having practiced this for a while, this Zen practice, which is also the practice pointed out in a couple of these slogans, it's not easy to do this, and the learning goes on forever. There's absolutely no way we can ever get to the bottom of it, and there are many Zen teachings that point this out to us. This is one of those delusions that somehow, if I study enough and practice enough and go to therapy enough and take enough classes and et cetera, that I will fathom the nature of humanity. I will understand what it means to be human, and then I won't have any more problems. And everything will be smooth sailing from here on in. But in my experience, it doesn't work this way. There is a way that we grow in wisdom and understanding and compassion and in balance and equanimity, absolutely. But circumstances keep arising that throw us off. And it's just always this way because, as we heard in the Five Remembrances, we are of the nature to grow old, to get ill, to die, and everyone that we love is in the same situation. So there's always something unexpected coming from around the corner. Always something. We think we've solved it. We know how to do fill in the blank. We know how to grieve because we've read all the books and we lost somebody once and we managed to transcend it. But boy, the next death, it's not like any of the others, even though Dylan Thomas says that after the first death, there is no other. On one level, that's true. It softens us, that soft spot, that tender point that the teachers talk about in the Lojong teachings, the bodhicitta being that tenderness, that woundedness, as Trungpa says. We are wounded over and over and over again. We learn to live in and from those wounds as they transform into compassion. And the world keeps offering more and more and more stuff. It's endless. It's unbelievable. I mean, really, some of the things going on the past couple of years in the world, in my personal life, in the life of this Sangha, I would never in a million years have predicted these things. And yet, if I just take a few steps back, of course they happened and are happening. This is the way life is. In and out and in and out. The waves crash in and the waves fall out, and this is how it is. And, you know, we can't predict the causes and conditions that create circumstances. Most of that, those causes and conditions, in fact, I would say pretty much everything is unknown to us until the moment that it's known. We can only know what we have learned in the past, but up until this moment, that's all we get. And then the future, really big mystery. We think we can predict future outcome based on past circumstances. Every financial advisor will tell you that's a delusion. And everyone who's tasted the unexpected quality of life will tell you that it's a delusion. And yet, human beings like to make patterns, try to figure out the way things are going to be based on the way things were so that we can protect ourselves from harm. And there's just no protection. So these turning all mishaps into the path is recognizing that all dharmas, everything that arises, is an opportunity to learn once again and for the very first time, how is this set of circumstances to be met? There's no way to know until we know, until it arises. And so the Lojong teachings advise us to see confusion as Buddha and practice emptiness, to see confusion as the four kayas, and that seeing this confusion itself is unsurpassable shunyata protection. So practicing emptiness is the way Norman Fisher talks about, because shunyata means thusness, great unfolding of everything as having no differentiation. Nothing is differentiated from anything else according to one view. And I'm going to talk about that view in a moment, that flexibility of view that's so important in our practice. If we see everything as emptiness, we're useless to meet the suffering of the world. It's handy to ground ourselves in it because, you know, it is the way things are. Don't believe me until you've tasted it for yourself. But according to what I've come to understand, yeah, shunyata, it's the world. It's the great field of Buddhas. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas, everywhere reflecting, everywhere being everything. This is the great shunyata life, the view from the world of emptiness, the view from within emptiness. Everything is this, everything is this. Thus, just this. Oh, it's such a relief to taste it. Often we only taste it for a brief moment, and then we get caught up in how great it was. And then we try to figure out, how did I do that? And let me see if I can keep doing it. And it doesn't seem to happen that way. It comes up as grace. It comes up unexpectedly, like a delightful surprise. Sometimes it lasts for a while, sometimes just for a brief moment, a millisecond. But whether we notice it for long periods of time or for short periods of time, it's always here, holding us up, breathing us, beating our heart, circulating our blood, making the world turn, letting the seasons shift from spring to summer to fall to winter again and again and again. Who owns the weather, as Joan Tollefson advises us? Who makes the world turn? I got to tell you the bad news, that it's not you. And hopefully that's good news. It lets you off the hook. So shunyata, we say, is a protector. And in Tibetan Buddhism, and also in traditional Japanese and Chinese Buddhism, and Korean Buddhism too, I believe, there are these personifications of these protectors. Shunyata, protection, is personified by these figures, which in Tibetan Buddhism there's a visualization of them. The great bodhisattvas that we read about in Lin Zhi's text today, Avalokiteshvara, who is the great embodiment, personification of compassion, and Manjushri, who's the great embodiment of wisdom, of cutting through delusion, and Samantabhadra, who is the great embodiment of clear activity, of energetic activity. And these three, Lin Zhi tells us, are no other than ourselves. They are, in fact, every single one of us. We might take them and extract them and put them outside of ourselves, but really they are active as our own wisdom, our own compassion, and our own awakened activity. This is how it works. And the kayas, seeing confusion as the four kayas, the kayas, it's important to understand, are also embodiments of this shunyata, this awakened view. And they arise in different ways as perceptions, really, through our meditation practice. Those of us who do shikantaza or breath practice know, when we're sitting in full presence in our bodies, with our breath, with the arising of thoughts and emotions and sensations and sense perceptions, we have all these energies that arise in different forms. Sometimes they are clear seeing and sometimes they're confused. And when we get up from the cushion or from the chair, from our sitting posture, and begin to walk or do a caretaking practice for the temple or go back into our daily lives, which are no other than this practice life that we're living, just different things to to do, really. In those moments, we embody wisdom, compassion, and especially Samanta Bhadra, the enlightened activity, the awakened activity. We embody these great bodhisattvas, these wisdom beings, because that is who we are at our root. And kaya is a word that means body. So we say that the Buddha, the awakened nature, bodhi, manifests in the body. Manifested in the body of Shakyamuni Buddha 2,600 years ago. And if we pay attention, we realize that it manifests in the bodies of everyone and everything. In the birds, the juncos, I've been informed they are, in the backyard at the bird feeder and down near the pond. The fish, who I hope are still alive and very, very quiet at the bottom of the pond on these cold, cold days. The grass that is just waiting to sprout forth again when the warm weather comes. And every being, the raccoons and the squirrels and every human being, everything is the body of the Buddha. There is no thing that is not. And yet, we see it from four different views. In Zen practice, we only talk about three kayas, but in Tibetan practice, they add a fourth kaya, a fourth body. So the first one, which we've been talking about quite a lot, is the Dharma kaya, the body of the Dharma, the body of the teachings, the body of awakening to this truth that everything is Buddha, everything is awake. When we are embodying the Dharma, everything is thusness. Everything is shunyata, this reliable emptiness is one of the words used to describe it, fullness, the absolute. Everything is this. Everything, just nothing getting in the way of fullness. The Dharmakaya is sometimes in Zen teachings we say that it contains all the other bodies. And I think that might be a nice way to see it. Those of us who work with koans see that some koans point us to the Dharmakaya. Not all of them, but some of them, it's important to be able to approach from the view of this arising of the way things are as thusness. Very important. So Dharmakaya is one of the bodies. And then there's Nirmanakaya, which is the activity body. This is related to Samanta Bhadra Bodhisattva, the enlightened activity. This is when we stand up and sit down, when we see time moving, aging, and illness and death arise out of things changing, things moving, nothing staying the same. If we live only in the Dharmakaya, we really starve ourselves of the amazing quality of activity that is open to all of us. The Nirmanakaya, sometimes represented by Shakyamuni Buddha, because he, like Jesus, came to the world to embody awakening. This is this embodiment of awakening. The even though Dharmakaya is called the body of the Dharma, the Nirmanakaya is where we really can perceive enlightened activity. So standing up, getting in line for a meal, serving the food onto our plates, arranging flowers, cleaning the toilet, taking a walk, all of these things are the Nirmanakaya manifesting itself. And then there's, I have to say, my personal favorite, partly because we like to say that people awaken in different kayas. The first experience of awakening comes through different means. In the field of modern mindfulness, the Nirmanakaya is very important, that activity body. We slow down our walking so that we can really feel our walking. We progress through all the sense perceptions and the different ways of perceiving. Nirmanakaya, so important. And so you may have tasted the Dharma through Nirmanakaya first, or you may have tasted the Dharma first through the Absolute, through the Dharmakaya. For me, my first taste came through the Sambhogakaya, which is sometimes translated as the bliss body, or the dream body, the magical quality of everything having its own light, everything shining forth as the Buddha. This is different than the Dharmakaya, where there's just this, just thusness. In Sambhogakaya, there's, whoa, light on the floor, and oh my goodness, the taste of this amazing soup, and on and on and on and on like that. So sometimes the first taste, literally, of awakening is through the Sambhogakaya. It's called the dream body because it's such a mystical understanding. The great mystics of all religious traditions, when they write about their experience of God, and so Rumi and all the great saints and teachers in Judeo-Christian and Muslim teachings, we find a real strong element of Sambhogakaya, even to the extent that some saints talk about being in love with the world. I think Sambhogakaya is really an opening to kind of falling in love with this amazing universe always presenting itself to us in all these various ways. So Dharmakaya and Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya, thusness and activity and bliss or dream-like appreciation. Sometimes it's called the appreciation body, appreciating everything, which of course connects to some things like the previous slogan, be grateful to everyone. And we might say appreciate everyone, appreciate everything. So in Tibetan teachings, there's a fourth kaya, and it is svabhavikakaya. I think I said it right. Svabhavikakaya. And this is an interesting view, taking all three kayas and noticing them arising together. There is no longer the differentiation that I've just been explaining to you between thusness, activity, and appreciation. There is all of it arising together. This is quite an amazing experience. The mind can't go any place in this kaya. It just is full of the presence of everything. And I have to talk about it sequentially because language is sequential. But it's the arising in the activity of the appreciation nested in the awakened body. This is all of it together. And this is, even in Zen, we have a teaching about this. We appreciate form, we appreciate emptiness, we appreciate form and emptiness. We find a way to embody form and emptiness in the forms of practice, the bowing and the sitting. And then it all gets thrown away. In the Oxherding pictures, we talk about returning to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. Everything is just this life, all arising together. We no longer even think about Buddhism or Zen or Kayas or any of these teachings. And this is where, when we see confusion, that is the natural arising of the mind trying to figure things out, if we see them as the four bodies gradually replacing each other from moment to moment to moment, sometimes arising together, sometimes within each other, sometimes differentiated, this is where we can feel the unsurpassable shunyata protection. So Norman Fisher says, see confusion as Buddha and practice emptiness. These Tibetan translators say, seeing confusion as the four kayas is unsurpassable shunyata protection. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and remember that this talk is being recorded, so if you want anything not to be recorded, just say the word and we will shut off the recorder temporarily. And we'll go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Melissa.
Jamie.
Jenny.
Ray.
Craig.
Susan.
Harold.
Pat.
Bill.
Fabian.
And Alan.
David.
So, you know what to do.
It's hard not to bliss out after Sunday.
Little Sambhogakaya. Kaya. Yeah, great.
Yeah. It's nothing to hold on to, yeah.
And yet, I mean, this is actually a beautiful demonstration. Yeah, here it is, the Samogakaya, and then, you know, you make eye contact with me and you speak, there's the Nirmanakaya. It's great. No problem. It's not that one is better than the other. But they just keep, it's a little dance of view and action. And, yeah.
I want just to help my own understanding of, because there was a lot in that. Thanks so much for that.
I know, I was going to talk about two of them.
Yeah.
One is enough, right?
But there was some, like a few years ago, there was a really interesting piece in one of the Buddhist magazines by someone who had been Trungpa's teaching assistant at Boulder. This was before Naropa. It was like UC Boulder. And Trungpa was teaching this course on Mahayana Buddhism. And one day he comes up to the blackboard and he draws those two wings that makes a bird. So he draws the two wings. And then he asks the students, what is this? And they say, well, that's a picture of a bird. And he says, no, that's a picture of the sky. And so the implication was that we can perceive the Dharmakaya only once there's Nirmanakaya. And then the follow-up was the Sambhogakaya, was the light flashing off the bird's wings and the cut of the bird through the air and the light that, you know, we feel in that. So I just wanted to ask about that part, you know, that you need the two wings before you see the sky. Does that make any sense?
Well, I appreciate that drawing the sky in that manner and calling attention to the interrelatedness of everything. My understanding of the Dharmakaya is that it is impossible to perceive it, that the Dharmakaya is this deep silence, is the source world where we can... we can experience it, we can rely on it, but nothing can actually be said about it. So there is no drawing in the Dharmakaya. But out of the Dharmakaya, we hear the call of the bird, or we see the bird, that there is this this deep source world, the Tao, we might call it, that cannot be expressed. It is dark. And dark is sometimes used for the absolute. When we talk about the absolute in Zen, this emptiness, this darkness that is full of everything. And that then out of that, Sambhogakaya appears, Nirmanakaya appears. So that's another way of looking at it.
And just to add, you know, that every metaphor that we can come up with for any of this, in any way we talk about it, is partial. And especially, I think, the idea that it's a 1-2-3 kind of process, or a 2-3-1, or a 4-3, you know, anything like that. My experience of people and of myself is that people open where they open. And so some people will live in the Nirmanakaya for a long time without any sense of this great darkness. And then a flip will happen and it'll be like, whoa. Right, and it's not that they haven't really experienced awakened activity. But there's always more. It's like, I'm gesturing around the space with my hands, because this is another metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's not orderly. At least from the Zen point of view.
So if I could just follow up briefly. Yeah. But the way that you said, someone will stay with the Nirmanakaya for a long time before the Dharmakaya opens up, I think that was the point Trungpa was trying to make. Because he didn't represent anything to show the sky. Mm-hmm. He just showed the bird. Mm-hmm. And then, and nothing, no representation. Mm-hmm. But now there's some way to imagine or access. It's hard to know what verb you would use.
Yeah, right.
But the idea that I guess the implication is, if we had no form, how would we know emptiness? Yeah. And we start with form. But I think the most important thing that you just said was that it's all metaphor and we don't want to get caught up in them. And I thought that one was kind of lovely. And I also see how it could be really confusing.
Yeah, and let your confusion be the kayas.
Right. Yeah. I used to teach photography, particularly black and white photography, and one of the things I would do at the first class is I would put up a black and white photo, of a squirrel. And I would say, what is this? People say, well, it's a squirrel. And I'd say, no, it is not a squirrel. These are silver crystals on a piece of paper, and some are dark and some are light. So when Trungpa says, what is this? We could say, it is chalk on a blackboard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the in mindfulness-based stress reduction, which I used to teach, we would do that same thing, when we were teaching perception. So we would make a little thing like that and then say, what do you see? And every answer was correct, right? So people would say, it's a bird. And other people would say, no, it's the sky. And people would say, it's sort of a shape, an M. And somebody else would say, ooh, it's breasts. And the other person says, it's mountains, and, et cetera, right? And then somebody, almost always in the class, would say, it's chalk on a blackboard. And so all of these views are correct. That's another part of this, right? Every view is correct. But the view that we tend to fight for is what imprisons us. And it's important to see the pattern that we tend to favor and realize there's more going on than that. And then the other thing that I love this story, and I'm probably going to get it wrong, but this is told about Pablo Picasso, who was on a train going somewhere in France, and he was sitting next to a man who was talking about his wife, and Picasso said,
the guy was criticizing Picasso, right?
That's right. Oh, you tell the story.
Yeah, he was saying, how come you don't draw things like they are?
Right.
You draw all this crazy stuff. And then Picasso said, do you have a picture
of your wife? Yeah. And so he took out a little photograph of his wife, and Picasso looked at it and said, she's so small.
and flat.
So small and flat.
And just more on these, the kayas, that even as we practice in our zazen, we can be aware of a manifesting or working in certain kayas. So in our zazen, sometimes, and maybe we just notice this, that there is some sense of that depth and silence. And please don't be intimidated into thinking you don't know what this is. Because I know sometimes I listen to, oh, the absolute, I wish I knew what that was. It sounds really nice. You all know. We all have tastes of this. And sometimes in our meditation, that is what arises, some kind of depth or openness. And sometimes, you see the light on the floor, or a thought flashes, and a picture or a memory comes up, a memory of you know, your daughter when she was 2 years old, whatever. That's Sambhogakaya, and we can practice in that arising and the appreciating whatever arises. And also in the Nirmanakaya, we can practice manifesting our great love, doing nothing, but engage in our practice as activity, as enlightened activity. And so from the outside, it looks just the same, but they're different, and they are the same, but they're different ways in or understanding that can be helpful as, oh, yeah, this is, I've heard of this. Right? Yeah.
Just more on not understanding the kayas. I'm just, all the examples you give, everything shining with the light and dissolving and blissing out, and that I can get, and I don't know, I get hung up on these words, and I want etymology. Mm-hmm. I want, okay, kaya's kind of body. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, I just lose them as soon as they're said. Which yeah. one's which, and then I think I kind of have a handle on what dharma means, and would it help having etymology? No, I don't think so. So I don't know that it matters what sambhoga and nirmana mean. I don't think it'll help me remember. It's just this. The words make this something happen.
Right, and I think that it's really something to respect in how your mind. Learns, right? That everybody, some people, the word is the real nice doorway into the concept. And for others of us, the experience is much more important. And really, you all of us want to honor that. And I love that, you know, this slogan starts with confusion, right? It is not a problem. Confusion is the kayas, right? And, you know, when David was talking about the, everyone knows those moments, the darkness. The funny thing is about human beings is that as, say, we're sitting and suddenly everything drops away, within a few seconds, if not faster, anyone who's heard a teaching like this will say, oh, that was it! That was it! How great! Oh, yes! Oh, wait. Right? And it's already filled up the space. So the idea is, you know, not even to bring to Dokusan, hey, I had this great experience, because, you know, it's just like you gestured in front of your face, just the concept's getting in the way. But the thing itself is always alive, and it manifests to anyone who knows how to see it. When somebody's really present in a certain way, and it's even horrible to say these things, because then people, well, probably it doesn't manifest in me. You know, it's obvious that I'm just not. But the thing is, it manifests in everyone. You know, somebody was telling me recently a story about serving soup at a retreat and kicking over the bowl of somebody that they just served, you know, and that was perfect Nirmanakaya activity. Not a problem. I mean, it created a kerfuffle, you know, as these things do. But so what? You know, then we go to the next thing, right? And so everything is like this. We tend to, you know, get caught in this. One of the things I love in this place too, and it's arising for me, you know, San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross, wrote these beautiful poems about his path to awakening, essentially. And he called it the dark night of the soul. And the dark night of the soul is the way many people talk about kind of that awful place of doubt and confusion. But there's another way of looking at that phrase, the dark night of the soul, which is, it is Dharmakaya manifesting itself. You know, you have to be willing to enter the darkness, to hang out there without filling it up. And that takes a lot of courage, I think. So no need to understand any of this stuff. And to really value everything that arises as the Dharma means that sometimes we're really embarrassed and humiliated and regretful, and sometimes we're happy and excited, and it doesn't matter. But this meeting all the time.
And as you say, rather than, so the slogan is not understand the three or four kayas. The slogan is confusion is. So if, how many of you are familiar with confusion?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
My master has spoken. So this is the good news, that this is not about trying to understand Buddhist concepts. And it's always so dangerous to talk about this stuff. But I think we're doing it, trying to tie it in, and that entry point is confusion.
So David, where is confusion? Which kaya, or less of which kaya is this? The confusion, all four. The aching knees,
yeah.
All four. The circular thinking, all that.
All four.
Yeah. All four.
Yeah. Right, and just to demonstrate that, so all four. So the one that I barely know how to pronounce, the Tibetan one, Svabhavikakaya. Have you heard that word before? Yeah, anyway. Yeah, so sva, you know, means thus. So it's just this constant arising. So your knee hurts. Is that the problem? And so, you know, right, that's all there is. And then there's also, you know, as the, wow, what is pain? That could be the appreciation body. And then, you know, boy, I better get some of this. Maybe I need to rub this during the next walking period, do something, feel how it shifts and changes my walking to have this. And, of course, pain. Okay, yeah, that's a concept. So it's just this continual shifting of view. And so we both had the same impulse at the same moment. It's all four. Everything is all four. And we're just saying four. That's like, you know, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 42 is the secret of the universe.
42?
Yeah. We don't know. And David has a book that, what is called the Numerical Discourses
of the Buddha, where all the Buddha's teachings are presented. First, all there's only one thing. And then there are two things. There's form and emptiness and all the two teachings. And then all the three teachings. Oh, there are three things. There are these three and those three. And all the way up to, you know, 10, 11, 12, and up to 42. This is the answer.
Well, and 108, yeah. And 108,000.
Yeah.
10,000 things. Yeah, it's great. It's a nice way to remember stuff.
But when this stuff makes your head hurt, as Katagiri says, mm-hmm. Just take the next breath. You know, this is our way. And traditionally, Zen has been always held in the context of this web of teachings. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly in China, the people that first embodied Zen were very well versed in the sutras, and in Korea and Japan up to this day, you don't just meditate. If you're becoming a monk, you study the sutras and study the thises and the thats. And I think in American Zen, it's been much more focused on meditation. And first without that context. And I think what's happening now here in our Sangha, and I think maybe in American Zen in general, is this sort of reweaving. So knowing this context, doesn't change our practice really, but it is can be helpful. But we can feel here how tricky it is, how much the mind then comes in and says, well, I better understand this if I'm going to be a good Tenzo. If the Tenzo doesn't know Sambhogakaya from Nirmanakaya, we're going to have dream soup. And the bowl was empty.
Empty bowl.
No, Jenny, that's not Nirmanakaya. But I think she knows so far.
Yeah, now I'm really afraid about lunch. But there is the snack table. Susan has become our snack master, so thank goodness we still have nuts and fruit. But the other piece of this, which I think is really important around the way we learn in Zen, and certainly in, and this is an American thing, experiential learning, John Dewey, that you You experience things. You study things. You know, but it's not till you experience them that you go, oh, right. So we chant all these, you know, now we have a 90-page chant book. It's full of words. Just word, 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 word. And we just chant this stuff. And most of the time, we don't know what is going on in that chant book. Or those of you who study koans, you know, you've had the experience of working with koan and just completely impenetrable. And then suddenly, oh, there's a line from a chant. Or a line from a koan. Even those of you who don't study koans hear us talk about koans in Dharma talks, or you hear about the four kayas, and at some point you actually have an experience that makes you. Then you have a way of talking about it to another person who knows the same vocabulary. This is what James Ford calls it, the language of dragons. You know that this is you to know how to speak this language. You just have to, like a baby, is immersed in language. Babies do not come out of the womb speaking French or German or English, right? But they're immersed in it. And then it starts to come together, and then they can speak it, right? And we all were like that. It's one way of learning languages. It's just the immersion method, not the study method. So this is the immersion method of Buddhist teachings. They do not make sense. They do not make sense. They do not make sense. And then suddenly one day, oh. And right, I wonder, just raising your hand, how many of you have had the experience of a line from a koan or a line from the chant suddenly appearing and it makes sense for the first time? And anybody just, yeah, so many of us are raising our hands. And that is how it appears to work. It's the other opposite way from study, 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 and then no. This is immerse, 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 and then knowing arises on its own. It's a very different kind of a learning. And so maybe with that, enough talking.